Well, my hope is that there will be, that no, that Bob will, and I will spend no more than half the time talking ourselves, so that what other people say will be useful and there'll be information that's not on the slides. Bob has said to me, these are your slides, you defend them. So I'll start. So for something like the last 8 years or so, Bob and I have been working on writing GSAS2. It is far more Bob's effort than mine, to give credit where it's due, or punishment where it's due, whichever. This is what it is. It's a replacement and more for what's been up till now our greatest hits, respectively GSAS and XPGUI, with a more modern open source package that does a lot more. And I think we've done that. The goal in GSAS 2, unlike GSAS and XPGUI, was to support all aspects of structural crystallographic analysis and more from beginning to end. And as you'll see, we've done that. We're aware that things have changed from when GSAS was written. Processing one powder diffraction file on your VAX was something of a challenge. Now people are collecting thousands of data sets, and we've got to adapt to that. It's written in Python, largely. Visualization is a big aspect of what we do. I won't be really talking about that direct. I mean, I won't be showing examples of that, but the idea is that there are lots of places where, you know, you can present somebody with a table of numbers that doesn't mean anything, like spherical harmonics. They don't even mean anything to me or Bob by just looking at those numbers, correct? But if you provide, they're just a bunch of numbers. But what GSAS2 will do is it will show you the probability of finding a crystallite in a given orientation as a three-dimensional plot, which allows you to interpret spherical harmonics. Actually, it doesn't do that. It does a pole figure or a reverse pole figure.
Actually, yes, it does.
Okay.
It does pole figures, inverse pole figures, and then 3D pole distributions.
Right, but it depends
on
which...
pole figure is a projection of that.
But it actually depends on which of the two spherical harmonics you do.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. So one of the things that that we've changed in terms of doing Rietveld fitting is the way that profile parameters are handled. So previously, if you've used GSAS or any of the other Rietveld programs, you have a bunch of profile terms, some of which are instrumental, some of which are sample related, and some of which are both. And in order to do Rietveld fitting, you need to understand that, and it gets sort of complicated. And what we've done in GSAS2 is sort of rethink this process and say, okay, you start from hopefully knowing your instrumental parameters. That's the first thing you really need to do. Once you've found those, you never touch them again. And there are separate parameters for dealing with crystallite size, broadening, and dealing with microstrain. And again, thinking that further, well, you want to be able to, traditionally you've been able to handle microstrain either as a single term or expanded based on the symmetry of your system. And that's known as the Peter-Stevens model. You want to be able to do the same sort of thing for crystallite size broadening, and we've also introduced an intermediate, which is you just simply say, okay, we have a preferred axis, and they're broadening either on the axis and depending on how far you're off that axis. So that's the uniaxial. So that simplifies things. It's designed around a GUI from the beginning, and the design goal has been to make it novice friendly, but also very powerful in the hands of experts. You may have different opinions whether we've achieved that goal, but that's what our goal is. So there's a paper, we hope people reference it, and that sort of brings me to the next point, which is that we've been trying to put all the information related to things onto the web. The web homepage has installation instructions. Those we have tutorials. We don't have a manual, but we do have basically work-through examples for many of the capabilities. And I think the current count is that there are 27 work-through.
28.
28. Okay. Work-through examples. Okay. There's also extensive documentation, probably more for Bob and myself to use, that describes the internals of the code, listing every major routine and what parameters it takes and stuff like that. We have a mailing list. And if you go to the website, you'll see project tracking. We don't, for example, we haven't written a roadmap of what we're doing, but if you go to the timeline, you'll see what code changes have taken place. And it's worth mentioning that we encourage people to update to the latest version, which may mean this afternoon's version of the code, because we don't want to get bug reports for something that we've already fixed.
And the current version number is like 2835 or something like that. So there's been a lot of updates.
Right. Let's see. What else? Okay. So, all right. So, wait a minute, let me just see something. I feel like I slipped, gone past a slide that I wanted to show. Yeah, I somehow missed this one. Okay. So, it's worthwhile noting that GSAS 2 is intended to replace GSAS and ExpoGUI. This is getting a lot of use. GSAS and ExpoGUI are getting a lot of use. For archaic reasons, GSAS is not tracked by Web of Science. You have to go to Google Scholar to find out what's being used for it. But ExpoGUI is, I thought that we were on it starting a downward curve here, let's say, last year, but it's still getting pretty heavily cited. And it's used fairly heavily. I mention this because one of our issues is that we need to be able to get across to the people who fund us that this is something that's being used heavily across the DOE facilities. Those are old numbers. Okay. All right, so what does GSAS 2 do? Well, the first thing that it does, which a lot of people in this room are interested in, is that it pulls up area detector data, calibrates it, and integrates it. It does that well even when the detector is has a large angle correction. Fit2D, for example, does it wrong unless your detector is absolutely perpendicular. It's written to replace GSAS, which does fitting of both crystallographic fitting of both single crystal and powder data using any normal type of source, whether it's time of flight neutrons, lab data, or synchrotron data from either a high-resolution instrument like 11BM or area detector instrument. Unlike GSAS, there is no limit on the number of data sets you can handle at one time, and there's no limit on the number of phases that you can incorporate. When GSAS was written, 99 phases and 99 histograms was pretty well close to infinity for both, and it's hard to believe it, but the people who handle, for example, quantitative analysis of cement find 25 phases to be constrictive. So let's see what else. You can do peak fitting, auto-indexing, something you couldn't do in GSAS, structure solution by either Monte Carlo simulated annealing or charge flipping. Charge flipping is simpler. Try that one first. more recently added with stacking fault simulations using DFAX code. If one thing that's commonly done is people are not know the structure, but they're interested in either size or a microstrain fitting. Sequential fitting is when you have a single model and lots of data that you've measured in some parametric fashion. And that allows you to take a starting model and fit it to all of those data sets. If you have, once you have done that, you can then do parametric fitting to the derived parameters. And the last thing that I could think of, maybe Bob, you can think of anything I didn't put on this list, was particularly at sector one, you take a polycrystalline sample, you apply external stress, and that will deform the Debye cones, Debye-Schur cones, and by looking at that distortion on the, you can derive what the changes in the directional changes in the lattice parameters. So, what have we done that's new? Well, the stacking fault simulation with DiffX is pretty new. Bob, bless him, has worked through how to put in supersymmetry with 3+1. In other words, one incommensurately modulated direction, which he claims will fit just about everything that's out there in the literature. Yeah, there are very few examples of higher cases. Twinning was something I should have put on here.
Oh, twinning, yes.
Yeah, twinning should
single
be on here.
Twinning.
Single crystal twinning should be on here. Let's see. Okay. Let's see. The PDF determination from powder data has been there for a while, but it was unvalidated, and we put in quite a bit of work with folks from Sector 11, and we have a lot more faith in that now. Also, with the request of the people from Sector 11, we've put in a module that, well, actually, to be honest, Andre wrote the first draft of, to do automatic integration of data as it was coming off the instrument, and that's been changed a lot and improved a lot, and now we'll actually do PDF determination at the same time.
It can be used elsewhere.
Yes. It's designed, everything that we do in GCS2 is designed to be done in the most general way we can. We're interested in what your problem is, but we're a lot less motivated to implement it if we see it as a one-off solution that's only going to be used by one person or one instrument or something like that. So our goal is to try to do things in a general way. That's what the G is for. Let's see. Bob, and I have to emphasize Bob, handled colored space group fitting. So that's where you have commensurate magnetism. The sequential fitting, which is probably more I'm guilty over, has been expanded so that you can have heterogeneous parameters. So you can start with, originally the same parameters had to be used for every data set. Now you can go to a certain point, change the model, add more parameters, add a new phase, whatever, and proceed from there, and it will handle that. The installation procedure has been changed an awful lot. To make it a lot simpler, you now download one file and run it, or slightly different between Windows and the Unix/Mac environment, but still pretty straightforward. And that, once you do that, will go off and download the latest version of GSAS2 at the time you do the installation. For anybody who hasn't looked at the code, if you and download it and install it that way, once you've done that, it gives you access to, under help, an option that will allow you to do a very simple update and pull up the latest version. It also gives you an option to go backwards. So if you have a problem, if you think that, for example, this is different from what I got last week, you can go back and run last week's version of the program. If you do find that something works differently, let us know. So, because we don't, it's possible that what it did last week was wrong, but it's also possible that that we've introduced a bug that we don't know about. Let's see. And a request from Andre was, how do I do calibration where I know relatively, I've got multiple positions of my detector, but I really don't know what the position of the sample is. So that's been handled as well. Oh, that too.
Yeah. Determination, pretty much now you can determine the wavelengths. Just if your motor gives you a really nice position of the detector, so if you step exactly the same and you know calibrant, the Jesus now will determine the wavelengths, which is nice.
So what are we working on? Well, bug fixes, always. Bob has started working on scripting. This is something we've been talking about for a long time. The goal is, at least initially, to just handle the 11BM calibrations, which are done automatically using parts, right now, bits of using GSAS and bits of XBGUI. We do not know how much longer they're going to work. The goal here is that we do not see ourselves creating an application interface that handles everything that GSAS2 does. But as people come up with requests and say, this is something that I need to do, we'll try to figure out how to do that. It would be a huge, huge task to create an entire API. Bob is working at my behest to look at reflectometry fitting, and I think he's got a working draft of that at this stage. Next month, we're going to talk about that specifically. Let's see. Something I'm working on is this idea that people have been pushing for fundamental parameters in GSAS2. And it is possible, in theory, using the NIST code, that could be implemented and you would be able to do that. But I don't think that there's a real huge need for that. What I'm exploring, though, right now is that you can use the NIST fundamental parameters code, same way you would use, for example, Topaz, to generate what the instrument profiles should look like and then fit those directly. And my first trial on that using some parameters from Jim Klein was spectacularly successful. And I see this as a way of being able to generate instrument parameters, subject to how well it works with other types of instrument descriptions. And I need to test and see, you know, how it, does this work in general? Where does it or doesn't it work? Let's see. We want to do refinement of stacking fault parameters. That's not going to be fast, but it could be done. So it's sort of the equivalent of diffax++, but within a framework that allows you access to all the other various parameters. Stuff we want to get to is some of the stuff we've talked about seriously. Bob and I want to write a book that replaces the GSAS technical manual. That's the most useful third. It's the second part of the GSAS manual described. It's actually the only place right now you can go and find all the various equations that are used in crystallography, in particular in powder diffraction crystallography. One of the things that we need an example to drive us, but what happens when you want to do sequential refinement, let's say from a neutron instrument where you have two banks of detectors for every temperature or something like that. I've been interested in sequential fit restraints. I strongly do not believe in sequential fit constraints, so that will not happen. but restraints make sense. And we need an example, again, to drive that. So, you know, if something comes along which drives it, we'd certainly be interested. Python and WXPython are moving targets, and we need to consider the future releases. This last week, WXPython 4.0 was released, and it's going to break things. And we don't know how much, so we need to at some point start testing that. And there's always a need for more tutorials, just to catch up with what we've done, let alone with as we add more capabilities. So some point we would like to handle multiple core implementations so that if you have multiple cores on your processor, it can use those. That might be useful, for example, in the numerical derivative calculation for diffax, if you can do that. I started my career on some level with doing PDF modeling, and we have an interest in trying to do combined small box PDF Rietveld fitting. The real challenge in there is that you obviously want to lower the symmetry in some fashion for the PDF fitting and not for the Rietveld. And the question is, how do you do that? And I don't know the answer to that. I know how I did it when I worked for Takeshi, but I'm not sure that's the right way to go back, the thing to go back to. There's other stuff that we really feel needs to be done, but it's not really something that we can talk about doing right now with the resources that we have. First, we need a long-range plan that allows us to expand this, because I think since we figured out that the average age on this project was 65, we've each had a birthday or two. Neither of us have any plans on throwing in the towel anytime soon, but realistically, GSAS is something like 30 years old and still going really strong. XPGUI is about 20 years old. And we want to see that these things continue for that kind of time frame. And then there's some other things up there, incommensurate magnetic scattering. One of the things that has always been a goal of both GSAS and now GSAS 2 is that don't ask the user to supply any information that you either know or can be figured out for them. So, for example, if you use FullProf, you need to know what the site symmetries are for every atom that you add, so that you can constrain them appropriately. GSAS determines site symmetries. GSAS 2 determines site symmetries, but it doesn't yet do that for 3+1 symmetry. At least not for all.
Not for all.
Not
it does
for all.
For some, but not for all.
Yeah. Folks at NIST really would like to see us be able to do fundamentals parameters inside GSAS 2, and that will happen when they pay for it, or do it themselves. As we said, that we want to provide command line access to what's in GSAS 2, but it's not going to we can't imagine doing that on for every single thing that that GSAS 2 does at this stage. So, is there anything else you want to add, Bob?
I think there was something missing in the list of things that it can do, and that was small angle scattering.
Yeah, that's certainly missing. Yep. Yep. So,
somewhere.
Let's put it here. It's not that new. That's X-rays only, right?
That's X-rays. Probably should be able to do concentrated photons, but I've not tried.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And would you consider that, how far do you go in the small angle scattering analysis? Do you go all the way to full histogram, something that, like the programs that Jan Alasky has put together?
It basically duplicates what he does with his blessing.
And encouragement.
Encouragement. He said he would love to have me put him out of business.
Okay.
The other thing I should say about that is that because it's open source, one can add your own particle models. And someone has actually done that. They've actually proposed a model. He sent it to me, and I stuffed it into the code. There's another choice.
Yeah, we really do want to encourage people to develop code. I don't think we've had anybody who's been ready to actually check in their own modifications themselves, but that's actually available, and we could even potentially add an account to somebody who's outside of Argonne to be able to do code check-in. I'm not sure Bob would have trusted me with that with GSAS back in the day, but it's at least possible. I mean, we're real interested in questions like the one that John just gave us. You know, what does it do? Is it going to do this for me? And one of the things that we see something that is of value is for people to come to us and say, you know, this would be useful if only, or, you know, how do I? Some of that's better not answered in terms of, you know, in front of an audience, but we really want to facilitate having discussions, and on some level, this is work that's being done for the APS community, so that's why we're talking to you folks. Okay.
Brian, one thing that
I
thought of after my visit with folks at Los Alamos is that in the list of possible things to be done, maximum entropy.
Yeah, actually, that one's been on my personal list for a while.
Well, add it to the list.
Okay. Which list do you want it added to? This one? What's that?
Not that one.
The dumb list.
That one.
Yes, I like that too.
Maybe.
Down here, maybe? And that's for Fourier maps, or
yeah, it's actually improvement.
One of the things that made me sort of take that off of my list is that the max ent routines that were in SciPy have been taken out. I do invite you guys to give me stuff that you want to see here. So it's part of what the goal is, and also to identify. I mean, ask questions. I don't really have a whole lot more to say at this stage. So we've written in that reflectometry is going to be the next discussion topic, and I think the plan for that, Bob will give a demonstration of what he's got, and we'll talk about, you know, how is this going to work for what people want to do. And are there things that people want to do that we can't do conveniently? Okay. Things like that.
Can I then have a request for sure. July 10th topic?
Sure.
Sequential, parallel diffraction, sequential, defined and fit. Or sequential / parametric.
Mm-hmm.
Parallel diffraction.
I cannot type in front of an audience.
And I can participate in that as I collected the data, so we can actually work on it. And
okay.
Sure.
Are you going to show a little bit here? You mentioned kind of a more heterogeneous model where you can change things. That'd be quite interesting to see.
Okay. I am definitely not prepared to demonstrate.
You got 2 months.
Oh, then? Yes. Then, yes. I thought you meant now. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Sorry, I thought you meant right now.
That's so unreasonable. All right.
Let's see. No, it's absolutely. You can start with a demonstration of what's there, and that's absolutely fine.
So, and I just want to add a comment, which is probably was missed. What I think what is really great achievement for GPS-2 was was, I guess I have a very big issue with inputs and outputs, like the inputting formats of the data and outputting, because every different body diffraction program will require its own format of input, and another one will require different of output. So what is nice, at least in GSS2, that you can actually write small, short Python codes for your own input routine and output. So Bob and Brian provide some standard routines for most standard, like poly diffraction, PDF data, right? But and TIFF images and all of that. But if you, for example, you bought your own new detector, and you have your own totally different image format, you can actually have opportunity to write your own routine and put it, your own routine in the folder of GSS2, and it actually will recognize your files and will read it as is. But yeah.
Yes.
That's one of the great advantages of the gray hair. When you've done it three times, you realize you want to do it a better way.
Yeah.
And so the way that that's done is that, and this is taking advantage of object-oriented programming, but literally for some importers, you need something like 15, 20 lines of code, and it will support a new format.
Yeah.
Similarly for exporters. And you can look at examples of stuff that's already there, and you can, you know, sing along with Mitch. That's dating myself.
However, I will put in my comment about TIFF images in particular. The header that comes with most of the TIFF images that I see around here contain false information. So it's... All I can do is encourage the people who run instruments to get on the folks that do their software for data acquisition to fix the TIFF headers so that they have the correct information in them.
Actually, in some cases, that's...
Sometimes like that's hard to...
Yeah, with the high-speed detectors from...
Because it's some instrument manufacturer.
Well, no, but even on that side, the TIFF header, in order to save speed, they use the same TIFF header. If you're doing a really fast sequence of images,
yeah.
You don't change this TIFF header, but you might have something that you decided that you know, especially when you can customize what gets written in the header.
Let me give you an example of kind of information that sometimes has been incorrect on the TIFF header. The wavelength.
Oh, yeah.
The wavelength is almost, given at all, is almost invariably 1.54 or whatever it is for copper K alpha. Never what it is for the appropriate synchrotron. I have seen usually the pixel size is incorrect. That's catastrophic to not have correct pixel size. Once in a while, the size of the image is incorrect. Another sort of catastrophe.
Well, actually, I think it's...
That breaks things.
Yes.
That breaks things.
Well, the way that this works, unfortunately, for reading TIFF images, there is a routine that goes and it looks at the header and tries to figure out from what's wrong, what actual type of detector it is.
It tries to figure out what kind of a detector it is and where it came from, and from that produce the correct information for the various characteristics of the header, of the image, despite the fact that what was on the header is incorrect.
So I don't know if this would be enough for a topic, but handling metadata, how you're doing it now and how others, have others found a way to, or if
what's
people have a separate file, are there different ways that people have solved far and maybe to discuss
that has been solved. Some of them are,
whether they're officially sanctioned or not, you know, I don't.
Yeah.
We have tended
that might
to
be good
with
to know.
As they've been presented to us. In other words,
and probably within that range of
a fake file
solutions that people can
with
file
lots of, with lots of entries, and other people have individual files for each image, and both solutions have worked. The key here is that there needs to be consistency.
Well, you need
how the files are written.
Yeah, you need to have something to link your your detector number to some.
Yep.
Yes.
So how do you make that one?
Yep.
Yeah, maybe then a good topic for August 14th.
Okay. All right.
Is it likely to be the week of the DOE review?
That may be, you're right.
That might be the week of the DOE review, at which point maybe.
Some.
Yeah, okay, we can. Well, I'll put it down and then we'll punt if that turns out to be a conflict. Let's see.
Well, metadata can come on, not only for images, for example, just whatever integrated patterns, right? Maybe you can integrate some metadata, right?
Okay.
And I know some of the routines, like for XYE files, for example, you guys looking for the temperature, right? If you reported the temperature, then you can. That's a great question. Given that grazing incidence is you can't use kinematical scattering theory. I'm not sure it's a good target for us.
Maybe not, but I guess there's a fair amount of small molecule crystalline samples that people would like to be able to know about the crystalline orientation of the space groups.
Okay.
I would suspect it's mostly a matter of knowing what the problem is in the band. Seeing what we do,
I think that would be something that you and I, the three of us, should talk about offline. And the real question in that area is, given that there are already several developments of people working on that, what can we add that's not already there? But it's, if for example, nobody handles crystalline polymers terribly well, then that would be something that would make sense. I'll put that down as something we should follow up first, probably privately. And if it makes sense to go forward with that, then I think it makes sense to, schedule it for a wider discussion.
So can I also add a little bit? Can you guys add it eventually to have a search match? Assuming you have access to database. Database from me, obviously. I'm going to database, but
yeah.
You have connection.
I have thought for a long time about wanting to generate peak listings from the crystallographic open database, and or to provide a routine that would generate that from ICSD. And then I've decided that I value the friendships that I have with the folks at the ICDD. And as much as I feel they deserve this, I'm not sure I want to do this. However, Tim Fawcett is actually, I worked with Tim Fawcett extensively when I was a graduate student, when he was a graduate student, and I was an undergraduate. But he's now stepped down as the director of the ICDD, so I'm not feeling quite as much loyalty there. So it's something worth thinking about. But I must admit that there is one other place where we've potentially, I'm halfway expecting a cease and desist. I won't specify that. In PDF.
No, it won't happen.
Oh, it could happen. It's just whether it could happen. It's just whether we. Whether we toss the letter or not.
As I pointed out to you, we already dealt with it once already.
Right. we've got to think carefully where we're going to make our enemies. But it's worth thinking about. I've written it down.
Second that. I think that'd be a very powerful extension if you could find a way to make it work.
Yeah. Well, for what it's worth. One of my previous programs, does do search match. It requires an antique copy of what's called the PDF2 database. And the ICDD recently wrote to me and said, can you take this out? because it's because the PDF2 database at that time was this enormous thing that you had to put on its own CD-ROM, and now it's emailable. And I told them, no, I couldn't take it out of the software because the software is no longer being updated, so it's their problem. But, so, it's an interesting question, and it will certainly get attention if we do it.
Okay. Searching isn't a problem, it's the database that's the problem.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
So,
maybe they can make up a new business model with this somehow.
Yeah.
Smart. If a user's willing to build their own database.
Well, you don't have to. You just have to. The crystal. You can download a copy of the Crystallographic Open Database. It's not small, and it's getting all of the new SIFs that are published in the ACTA journals. Doesn't have a lot of historical stuff.
Or you introduce a SIFs, which you created by yourself.
Right.
You know.
Well, realistically, if you have a search match out there and it doesn't have sodium chloride. It's not necessarily very useful. And you can't say, okay, let's make, you know, you've got to add that yourself. So, but I'll be honest, it's, at least for me, it's a lower priority than some of the other stuff we've talked about, but I think it's something that, I don't want to say, no, we're not going to do it, because it's worth thinking about seriously, and it's not that hard. Particularly since I've got some code that I can steal from.
Can I ask a general question about the model which you're looking to continue moving forward? I mean, right now it looks like the two of you are kind of doing the sanctioned versions of the code.
Mm-hmm.
But if others are developing pieces,
mm-hmm.
Is there a place or incentive or anything for people to put those in a common place? Like in MATLAB you have, user-defined space or something where, I might want to get one of Andre's, I have this detector and, he already wrote it, great.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe that's too small right now. To think
right.
About, but do you have a plan for that? To deal with kind of an open source-ish version of some of this?
Well, this is, it's open source.
I mean, it is open.
It's open source.
Open development.
But open development. I mean, collaborative development. How do we implement collaborative development?
Right.
I think that at least at the present, before any code goes into the program, either Bob or I want to go through it reasonably carefully so we don't introduce something that's going to cause problems or, and I think this is equally important, that doesn't frustrate users. On the other hand, we definitely want to encourage that. So we've gotten a couple cases where people have sent in bug fixes, please change this piece of code to this. We've gotten a couple cases where people have sent in code that we've added, more or less directly. In the case of Andre's interface, it worked great for him on Windows, and the first time I tried to run it on the Mac, it literally crashed Python. So, that was something that was a non-starter. And to be honest, it was not really compatible with our style anyway, so it needed to be rewritten. But, so I think you're asking another question, which is really important. What's the incentive for you or for somebody else to send something to us once you've written it? And that's a little harder, but I will make the comment that if you send it to us and it's incorporated in GCS2, we'll fix it if somebody reports a bug. And if it's not sent to us, then it could break. So for example, I wrote the sort of open importer and open exporter structure, never anticipating that it would ever be used in a batch mode, in a command line mode. Bob has just recently gone back and tried to fix things in most cases, with the exception of SIFs, so that you can do automated imports. And that required changing very small changes to all the importers that are there.
Some of them are not small.
Okay. Yeah, that's true.
Like a bit of reorganization.
Right. If your importer were there, we would have restructured it. If your importer is on, you know, in your computer and only, you know, and it's local to some environment, we're not going to know about it, and it'll be a responsibility. So that's the only incentive that I can think of, other than, you know, the other thing is that there's the goal of saying, okay, in the case of automatic integration, we'd like to get a paper out on that. And, you know, that's really, you know, Andre should be the lead on that, since it's really starting with his work and he's really championed it.
Well, maybe it's also would be good, like, since we already, for example, have importers, for example, for perchanometer detector, GE detector, and so on, maybe it would be a good idea, like, to organize space on the Jesus 2 website where you can put, like, for example, image importers. And, mm-hmm. And so maybe users can add, like, if they wrote their own importers, they can actually share it with everyone else.
Yeah,
so
we could do that. Although right now the thing that makes most sense is just to stick it into the source code tree, and then the next time anybody does an update, they get it. And it's not a whole lot of work for somebody to attach the file and on an email message, and then we put it in the source code tree. But again, you know. If this were something that you wanted to do, and I don't recommend it, but anyway, then we could very easily add you and you could stick them in yourself. We'd like to be convinced that you're going to put some attention into detail, but not that you might not, but yeah. So, I mean, they're solvable problems, but I think, you know, a lot of cases we don't solve problems until there's a need to do it. Are you comfortable with that? I mean, more stuff? Nobody answers. I start calling on people. So Ross, right, Ross, I didn't expect you here. What do we do? What are we able to do for you?
I was just curious.
Good. Well,
so
thanks.
I was just playing with it, and there's this GSAS2 data tree, and every time I click on something, a new window changes. Is that a mod?
That's intentional.
That's intentional.
Yeah. So the idea. Let's see if I can. I'm not going to try to pull it up, but so GSAS2 has four windows, one of which is just a console window, which we just print messages to. One is the tree. The way we've organized things is that you have a hierarchical file description. So, for example, you add a data set that we call that a histogram for historical reasons. And histograms have lots of things associated with them. They may have a peak list. They'll have instrumental parameters, sample parameters, and so on associated with them. So those are displayed hierarchically. And then you want to look at the details in a hierarchical structure. So if you click on the sample parameters inside a histogram, that's open. In another window, you will see the details of the sample parameters for that particular histogram. That's just the structure we work with. And then finally, there's also a graphics window, which may display two-dimensional plots or three-dimensional objects in a tab fashion. And again, so, you know, it depends on what you're looking at. If you're looking at instrumental parameters, it's going to give you a plot of what the instrument response function looks like. If you click on a powder diffraction pattern itself or the peak list, it's going to show you powder diffraction pattern optionally with the peaks on top of it. You click on the crystal structure and it gives you a three-dimensional crystal structure. So, and then there's other stuff. If you click on constraints, it doesn't show any graphics at all because there's no graphics that we've come up with that make sense for constraints. But somebody may come along and say it would be really useful if you plotted this. Then we'll probably add that. We're better yet, somebody will come along.
Can't think of everything.
Yep.
Well, Well, you're speaking of user like barriers or annoying users. and the one that tied into that is the windows come back their original size every time I open the new one. So I've resized it nicely to change my parameters for my phases and so on. Then I come back to it after going to a different window. It comes back and I have to resize it again.
Yeah.
One second then.
Yeah. Okay. I will make a note of the windows resizing and repositioning.
Has been a point of contention. I'm sure.
I mean, for what it's worth, we've addressed that. We've addressed that at least twice.
Yes, and I've seen the improvements. Yeah.
And no, I mean, we've had to take in many cases. We've had to take stuff out because it caused problems. and just as a bit of input, would you find it more useful if you had control over that and you could override the defaults? Would that be something that would be useful? Then it would always do the same thing.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't do what we did. Okay, so. Okay, and it's the sizing or the placement or both?
It's more size is more important than placement.
Okay. I don't promise a quick solution to that, but I can see how to do that. That's a really good thing too. That's part of what this is about.
It's a slightly thorny problem because some of those windows have a lot of information on them, so you want to show as much as possible. Some of them have enough information you can't show at all because it'd be wider than your screen, longer. And there's other windows in which shows hardly anything, so you wouldn't want those to be a huge window of empty space and look like a table up in the corner.
I might accept that. Just having one large window that...
That's what you'd have to accept is that. This would have almost nothing on it.
The multi-image calibration is that separately refines of different of the parameters, or is that so? I got three detectors where they all have exactly the same energy, but three different distances, three different direct beam positions.
So we did it for powder diffraction experiments and. In our case, we've been able to move detector from 300 millimeter to 1.3 meter away from the sample. And so usually, the final distance, it really depends on material and the user's problem. And usually we used to, just collect all distances 100 millimeter apart, from 1.3 meter to 200 millimeter for user, and after that user calibrates it. But very often users started collecting the data, you've given me a range of distances, I'll collect them all. So they collect one sample on a whole bunch of different distances, and they would need to calibrate everything at the same time. And so what we end up being doing, and so we would collect the data every 100 millimeter or so, and after that introduce all those images in JESUS-2. So we would move one detector on one wavelength.
But I mean, when you're actually, so you've got those multiple images, they're all being calibrated essentially separately.
Correct.
Separately, yes. There is two options in JESUS-2. There is a calibrate option where you select your first string, right?
Or recalibrate.
And then recalibrate.
Yeah, I do nothing about recalibrate.
Yeah, so they're pretty much what you're doing is recalibrating.
Right. What I'd love to be able to do, because I have three detectors, three different distances, and I'll put and be able to have, take one image with a mixture of lanthanum hexaborate and silver bean, and another with a spilling silicon grid for my small angle. So two different, you got two different sets of three images, and then you can even do multiple energies and be able to say, all right, I know my detectors are at exactly these three positions and they don't move. Mm-hmm. Now, give me, calibrate those two energies using those three detectors. And so you should be able to get a set of, okay, yeah, this detector is definitely here, calibrated across multiple energies. Versus these three detectors are in three, these three locations, calibrated, and then be able to calibrate this, it's definitely this energy. You know, it would give you a better restraint on those calibration parameters and give you much, I think, more accurate, you know, gauge. I do it, you know, sort of manually where I'm going, all right, I know I'm at 10 kV and this makes sense and this is the distance, okay. Go to 17, okay, 17's a little off, it's off by a couple of EV, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, if you know exact position of the detector, you actually have a choice to choose either you define distance or position.
Right. But it'd be nice to say, for example, you don't know exactly the distance, the sample is sometimes moves a little bit, so you're like, I know the relative distance never changes. Mm-hmm. I know the tilt, it might have some tilt, but it's not going to be changing across those energies. Now, because of the beam alignment and so forth, where the direct beam is hitting those detectors might be slightly different.
The center could change, but not the
exactly.
Distance. Yeah.
The center, but not the distance. The tilt, but not the tilt will.
Isn't that the type of situation that the absolute detector calibration
No, it does not. The absolute, what we're doing is we're doing a series of sequential fits, and then from that,
interpolating in between or something.
We don't interpolate, but we fit the secondary data, so it's a secondary fit.
Oh, okay.
I do that sort of manually, but right. That's all I do. Yeah.
I thought it was referring to how we determine our wavelengths.
You end up going back and you say, okay, we've derived these parameters from the mass from the individual fits. Now we're going to fix the mean parameters and go back and refine to a secondary fit, a tertiary fit actually.
Okay, we're looking at the way we determine the wavelength. Mm-hmm. That's probably how you do it. It's like take it at a couple of well-known separations, figure out the ring diameter, and then extrapolate back to zero.
That's pretty much exactly how we do it.
That is what it is.
Yeah, yeah. It's just that's a little bit different.
But that's different from saying that okay, we're going to build a large model at the beginning that has these parameters fixed in it and require, you know, for example, one wavelength for fitting multiple detectors from the beginning, which is what you're asking for.
Yeah, basically like.
Yeah.
Okay, here's 12 frames. These should have the same energy. These should have the same distance. And, fit everything.
Right, yeah. Thinking about this off the top of my head, it is worth noting that if you do a fit to least squares parameters,
mm-hmm.
It's completely equivalent to doing, that secondary fit is completely equivalent to doing it in one step as long as you carry the covariance matrix through.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't think we do, but the multiple calibration refinement would be a fairly big deal to implement. Having a more generalized secondary fit might make more sense. So that's something that might need, you know.
Stephen, I think it will do what it is you need to do.
Which way?
You need to do the three calibrations in sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you'll get a table of coefficients and results and distances and wavelengths and all that sort of stuff. And from that, I think you should be able to pull the
I don't, well, I
it's
don't think...
along the lines of then that, see, it should... You're not able to put in those any restraints.
No, but you can't put in restraints, but what you could do is you could, and I don't think we can handle the idea of saying, okay, we have three different wavelengths, but the tilts ought to be the same.
Yeah.
So I don't think.
And actually, that was part of the reason why I mentioned, because I've found now that as long as I, so my detectors are set up to be normal to the beam.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, anomaly don't have a tilt. And I find that if I when I was refining all the tilts each time, then from energy to energy, from time to time, my distances would vary more than they really can. Mm-hmm. You know, it made no sense. But as long as I said, oh, you know what, these things are plumb, they're all normal to the beam, let's not refine the tilt at all.
And they're just so far away that they are normal.
Exactly, and it makes very little difference. You know, it actually, I find it that I get a lot more errors that would creep in if I was to refine the tilt than if I just keep it, force it never to change. And so I just leave that, and then my distances are stable and everything else, and I'm like, well, yeah, but they're not really perfectly normal. They're you know, so it'd be nice to say, well, if I had enough parameters, I probably could refine the tilt and the distance simultaneous and have it be a stable distance and stable relative distances of those
right.
detectors.
Yep.
But, yeah, as it stands, I can't really do that.
I think what we should do is revisit what we've done for Andrag and see if it makes
sense. Yeah, it sounds so close.
It sounds like it's more than halfway there.
What you described to me in the beginning, I was so, yeah, we just need to switch the distance and wavelength. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
One last question for me, and since we're talking about calibrations, if people put in detector distortion corrections, known detector distortion corrections, to get...
There is one.
Yes.
Well, no, the...
Penetration correction.
It's not a... But it's not like... It's not like a... what do they call it? A... you know, it doesn't account for known aberrations of the detector. What do they call it?
Gainman?
No, not a gainman.
For example, if you have a fiber optic or
right,
something like that,
right.
Which would...
Oh, you're like a warp.
Right.
Yeah, there's a... I'm trying to remember the name. There's a name for that. And I can't think of it. Something.
Distortion grid. Distortion skew.
Well, the pin cushion.
Yeah. Pin cushion, that's what it is.
Well, the penetration actually simulates the pin cushion effect that you get in some detectors, which is because of penetration.
I think that's just good luck in this case.
Hmm?
That's just good luck in the case of the Perkinelma.
It doesn't do it though. Does it do it on a physical basis, or it's just whatever?
No. There's no. The pixel is where the pixel is. We do not have a map that would allow you to say this pixel is really here, even though, you know, we.
And so that's done relative to the direct beam.
Right. Yeah. So realistically, we have not seen a really strong need for that since you're doing radial integration, typically. But I could imagine that if you're caking, for example, it could matter.
Yeah, we need it 10 to the minus 4-ish in the relative. So, anyway, we can talk about that.
Yeah, we can talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah, but in terms of like the penetration, it was really a nice addition because at least for our detector,
mm-hmm.
it was, I guess for perconometer detectors, I guess the old generation detectors were made maybe by hand or maybe by some machine, but they were more or less flat, and at least the sensitive area, and there was not much of the penetration. But the newer detector, it have some kind of like a funneling effect, what we described, where the middle of the detector a little bit further away from the samples and sides of it. And
I mean, there can be manufacturing.
It's
Oh, yeah. The question in my mind is how you're going to figure this out in the first place. But
great difficulty.
Yeah.
It's going to vary
independently.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But anyway, the penetration correction actually helped us and helped us a lot. Like, without it, we could pretty much integrate the data up.
But it's not a real penetration correction.
Yes.
That's a misnomer in this case.
I mean, the way that we've done. I mean, you could get a well-known grid, right? An absorption grid.
Even that's really hard to measure. Yeah,
it can be hard. We've done some of it, and we've done, you know, moving detector with a slit. I mean, they're hard. Yeah. I mean, it's not something you're going to do in an hour.
We should get
Nino
and get him set up to do that routine
with
our
detectors. What are you supposed to do? Needed high energy.
We'll tell them it's implemented within GSAS. Two, we need the information put in.
Okay. Well, while they're at it, they can write the module for us that will interpolate the coordinates.
Wow. Yeah. Flood fields.
Amazing how easy these things are when you have someone else do it for you.
Indeed. Yeah.
or you say that sometimes.
They only have to write it. It has to be fast.
Yeah.
Other than that, it's not a piece of cake. Yeah.
Since we're on the topic of things that people can do for us, someone could write a universal tip reader.
Yeah. You've done that.
The problem with it, yeah. Exactly.
Mine is every case is in there.
Not just, yeah, it's not just the header having improper information. I mean, the TIFF header is dynamic by default. You can say, no, it's this big and put more stuff in it.
Yep.
So, yeah.
And then if it all fails, it just uses the regular sci-fi
label.
Right.
Which doesn't work all the time.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, it doesn't read the images correctly all the time.
Oh, yeah. That's yeah. Right. It only reads them the way they were written, which may not be the way you want them to be written.
Yeah, sadly, sometimes that incorrect information falls on the user who's collecting it or the scientist, the beamline scientist, too, because the software that they're using to collect it from the vendor, say in Rayonic's case, is the only one that I, of course, know, is, you know, you could say, okay, the wavelength is this. I'm not controlling the wavelength with that software.
Right.
You know, I'm controlling it with completely different controls, right. And you just enter it in there, and that's what gets put in the header. It's whatever is entered into the vendor.
You don't tell it anything, you get 1.54.
Exactly, yeah. It does make a base assumption of copper cannon.
Okay, well, we should probably start wrapping this up, but more stuff? Anybody who hasn't said anything yet?
Okay. I have some thoughts, but maybe I'll share them with you via email.
Okay.
Because
sure.
We're supposed to be in a group meeting.
Oh, sorry.
Emails are very, 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 very useful and welcome.
Easy to ignore, is that what you're doing?
What?
we tend to pay pretty close attention to them. Sometimes after we get the fifth from the same person in certain foreign countries who insists that we do their problem the way they want it done, we may not pay as much attention.
Yeah, and the other one is folks who ask questions that are obviously covered by one or more tutorials.
It's so much easier to go.
Sometimes the response is, have you done the tutorials? Okay.
Thanks.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, guys.